Hello and welcome to Citywire Funds Fanatic. I'm Gavin Lumsden and today I'm talking to Daniel Kohler of Bellevue Asset Management in Kuznach, Switzerland. Daniel's on the line to talk about BB Biotech, the Swiss-listed investment company whose assets he's managed for 13 years. Although, actually, Daniel, you're telling me you've worked on the team, on the portfolio, for nearly 20. That's a good long record.
Yes, thanks for having me, and absolutely, yes, thrilled to be here 20 years soon. It's going to be in spring. And I said, that's, I think, a nice coincidence as well, that I said BB Biotech will turn 30. So I have missed the first decade, so to speak, but obviously tracked the company back then. But very happy to now be part for almost two decades.
That is the big number we're here to talk about. BB Biotech celebrating 30 years since it floated on the SIX Swiss exchange in Zurich. So it's a good milestone to look back on its record. But before we get into that, Daniel, why don't you tell our listeners what BB Biotech does? I mean, I guess the name does give us a bit of an idea, but what areas of the biotechnology market is it investing in?
Yes, so BB Biotech is, as said, as a Swiss investment company, started in 1993 and since then has not changed. So our main focus is actually to identify and invest into promising biotechnology companies with a focus on human medicine. So we are not investing into life science tools or diagnostics or, for example, set the green or white biotech. We really consider only investment candidates that focus on the development of human medicine, because I think that's one of the most exciting and promising areas. And we have seen many actually very successful investment case of the past and are quite optimistic that this can continue on this basis well forward.
Okay, and so it's quite focused, and also you focus on medium-sized, mid-cap companies rather than the big pharma giants, is that right?
Yes, that's right. And I said the reason for that is, I would say the focus is not just purely on mid-cap. We actually start to look at even private equity companies or non-listed companies that are in, let's say, clinical or close to clinical development stage. And we start normally our investment cycle when companies are defined as more like smaller cap. So they can be a few hundred million to a billion or two in market cap size. Why you mentioned that and why most people perceive us to be a mid-cap investor, because the large part of our current portfolio exposure is actually in the mid-cap. So almost 60% is what we define as mid-cap. That's often companies we have invested for some years now. They have grown in sizing as position over time. And that's, I said, why I would say that the heavy weight or our investment focus in terms of short and mid-term performance is actually in the mid-cap space. And as we hold some large caps as well, these are said most often longer term holdings, where at some point we will then exit if these companies continue to mature and actually start to grow less. That becomes then for us, for example, an argument to, for example, take all the profits and reinvest into the next generation of attractive new ideas.
Okay, so so a good range of companies, but it is quite focused. You hold about 28 stocks at the moment, so that's quite concentrated. Some of our listeners, you know, like their investment trust a great deal, so they might be more familiar with Bellevue Healthcare, which is an investment trust, a sister fund, which is listed in London. What's the difference between what you do and what it does?
Yeah, I would say that I think many of the, actually, I said, I was actually part back then, actually launching the healthcare trust as well.
That's so right, the first see, 2 years you were involved with it.
Exactly, with Paul and Brett back then. So I said, many of the things we actually replicated in terms of, I would say, concentration, the number or the maximum number, so that we have actually, I said, I would say, quite a concentration, but still ample room actually to have a certain basket or portfolio approach. So on that front, it's very similar. I would say the scope mostly for them is they have the broad healthcare mandate in terms of looking for the best ideas and the best areas within all what healthcare has to offer. Our scope, as I said, is, if you want to say so, narrower in a sense that, I said, we focus only on, I said, smaller to mid-cap biotech companies with the focus set on human medicine. So that's, I would say, is the main difference overall. The rest in terms of structure, in terms of, I said, that we can work with leverage, that we have a concentrated portfolio, a mid to longer term investment horizon. I think most of the other, let's say, classical strategies hold true. The process is obviously slightly different, as well as the team. So I have a dedicated team on the BB Biotech front, where we are, I said, right now, seven colleagues on the portfolio management and analytical side. We have expanded that team 2.5, soon 3 years ago with a data science person that has been recently expanded to become a team of three. And I said we have some investor relation colleagues who are actually specifically on the BB Biotech mandate as such, if I can call it like that, because I said we have an independent board of directors. And Bellevue, said, has that mandate since its inception. And from that perspective, I said we have clear commitment, focus and dedication to BB Biotech.
Great stuff. So well resourced. Going back to the launch in late 1993, you know, did that reflect, you know, Switzerland's strength in pharmaceuticals? You know, we think of Switzerland, we think of Roche and Novartis, you know, big pharmaceutical companies.
Right. I would say that definitely helped. Back then, though, biotech was clearly almost completely US-centric. So in the 80s and 90s, you had the biotech industry to the large degree. In the US, I would say most of the pharma companies back then were actually so-called small molecule companies. So the classical biotech product, in a sense, to use a set recombinant protein production, etc., which clearly was the reason and foundation of the biotech industry. So these things were completely separate. And I think if a listener said to the founders of BB Biotech back then in, the early 90s, they say as well that pharma back then was not yet, I mean, obviously aware of it, but not yet investing into this. And that actually left a so-called gap or an interesting area open for investors like BB Biotech. And then I said to collect capital here from Swiss investor and some European investor and deploy this capital, I said, back then almost exclusively into the US biotech sector back then.
Okay, well, it's got a market value recently of 2.3 billion Swiss francs, which is about £2 billion. It's a good size fund. I wonder, is it well held by Swiss private investors, and how many people hold it outside Switzerland? Can you tell us about the investor base?
Yes, absolutely. So, interesting question. So, we have, we have a good sense of where the shareholder base is. The shareholder registration is not mandatory, so to speak, but nevertheless, over obviously now soon 3 decades, I think we have quite a good understanding. I would say it fluctuates somewhat, but I would say Switzerland has been always kind of like ranked number one in a sense, like 30 to 40%. Germany is another important factor. And then I said we have the UK and the Nordics. These are, I would say, the main four areas where I said we have a substantial shareholder base for BB Biotech over, the three decades that we're now listed.
So the shares are listed in Switzerland and in Germany, not in London, yes. but the shares are available. You can buy them on leading share dealing sort of websites. And the long-term performance has been impressive. According to your fact sheet, from the launch to the end of September, total shareholder return of over 1,800%, rather, well ahead of the NASDAQ Biotech Index, which delivered 1,175%. Now, that's in Swiss francs. Sterling shareholders would have got something different. But in your local currency, you are beating the NASDAQ Biotech. I was interested to see that the benchmark goes that far back, actually.
No, it does, actually. I said, although, interesting enough, if you even ask NASDAQ for the source of, you know, sometimes out of curiosity, we have asked, for example, for an analysis regarding membership and constituents back then, you get the answer from NASDAQ. There's no proof for what the data is, because back then, I said, the registration and all the information was obviously slightly different held and such. But I said we had biotech companies, many of the large caps that you still see in existence, like the Amgens and Gileads and Biogens and others of the world, that have actually launched in, I said, the late 80s, early 90s, and launched or issued as well or IPO'd in stock market. So we have set a long-term track record for I said, the US industry, a short-term out of obviously Europe and other areas. And I said the returns have been actually much more spectacular if you'd have had that dialogue, I said, in the 2021 timeframe, because said throughout the pandemic, obviously, we saw a certain rally and spike in terms of a lot of share price in biotech that played, I would say, a very important role as well for, solving the societal problem or pressure point that we had back then with the pandemic. And now the last 2 years, we actually have seen quite some drawdowns. But as you just pointed out, the biotech industry has proven itself to generate very attractive mid and long-term returns. It comes as well, though, with volatility. And said the last 2 years have been, I would say, disappointingly, at least for me, a correction. I think now even an overcorrection, but we shall see how this goes on. And absolutely, our ambition is as well on a forward basis to repeat the success of the past. Absolutely.
Well, Daniel, we'll come back. Yeah, we're in the grip of a biotech bear market. There's no doubt about it. Yeah, there's been that big sell-off, like you say, since 2021. But just looking at the long-term performance and the history of the company, can you highlight some of the main trends and highs and lows before the pandemic? Because clearly, biotechnology really came into its own when we're trying to beat COVID. But if you go back to the 90s, the early noughties,
2000s, etc. I said 1993.
What were people getting excited about in biotechnology back then? What's been changing?
So I said 1993. I would say it was mostly about, or when the launch period was, it was about to say, what can recombinant technology do? Meaning, if you do an industrial manufacture process, for example, for proteins, that I said the biotech industry started off, that was, I said, back then kind of like the revolution and triggered, I said, a lot of interest, new opportunities and new therapeutic areas that you could potentially tackle. Then obviously the spike we had in the 1990s and 2000s, that was around I said when the first human genome got sequenced, that it was about the genetic, I call it not revolution, but at least a deeper understanding, meaning back then it was perceived that, understanding the genome better would lead to faster, easier, and obviously as well more successful clinical development. That led then as well for one of the lows, let's say, or the down points in 2003 to 5, when I said some of these dreams shattered, and I said many of these very early companies actually failed then in even public markets or at a later point. And then actually from then on, we had multiple ups. I would say a very strong period as well for us has been 2010, 11 to 2015, 16. Interesting enough, that was, I said, when Obamacare, so for example, a big US healthcare reform kicked in. And initially, a lot of investors perceived this to be a substantial risk, didn't prove like this. We saw a lot of actually transformative medicine come around. One of the prime examples that comes to mind is, for example, hepatitis C got suddenly cured. We have seen, as I said, the introduction of the first genetic medicine like gene therapy and cell-based therapy. So we saw technology really starting actually to translate or result, if I want to say so, in more and more attractive and highly functional or helpful products for patients and for severe indication. And then I said, we saw obviously a bit of a US election cycle. The biotech market reacted quite negatively, for example, towards back in the election cycle when it was a race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I said Hillary, with a single-payer healthcare system, etc., seen as one of the major risks, obviously not she herself, but I said the Democratic Party with that strategy back then. We saw that the pandemic up and down. I said initially every market sold off, biotech rebound as well, and then overperformed because a lot of the vaccines and therapeutic products and diagnostics product came out of, I said, many of the biotech labs. Then I said the recent correction that we just touched on, which is said one of, I would say the sell-offs that we think is triggered obviously by capital markets, much more so than and obviously capital demand and alternatives like the large techs in the US right now, or a new field or disease area that came up like obesity that suddenly grabbed, so to speak, the spotlight and the headline and obviously as well the commercial success. And that has triggered, I said, some fundamental shifts and capital flows. And that's, I said, all a bit of the reasoning why I said we have now seen kind of like a bear market situation over the last one, almost now two and a half years soon, that the sell-off has continued.
So, you've mentioned the sell-off a few times. So shall we sort of start to get into that? Because, broadly speaking, the share price has sort of halved since end 2021. you know, in common with many other growth funds, you've been hurt by the increased inflation and the increasing in bond yields, and since the interest rates are going up, and that is seen to undermine the current value of sort of jam tomorrow stocks, if I might put it like that. But is that how you look at your portfolio? Are your because your top positions are quite revenue generating. You pay a dividend,
yes.
And assume you pay a dividend out of real investment income. Is that correct?
So I said it's not dividend income that we have out of the portfolio, because in biotech, as you pointed out, we invest in growth.
Right.
So we take it actually ultimately out of capital, in a sense that we say retained earnings, meaning, you know, we take profits out of the underlying investments. And that's actually the feeder, so to speak, of obviously the dividend payout that we have. So our total return is obviously a combination, I said, of the share price return. And you have to adjust for that, obviously, for whatever the dividend is. That's in general a 5% payout. But I said, given the more, let's say, or recent times, a bit more volatility, that can then even be a higher figure, depending, obviously, where the share price moves to. But I said, you know, the reason I don't see just the capital markets, or I said the interest rate as a bit of tricky, I said, I think that's the most obvious one, in the sense that people said, say, capital costs become higher, meaning forward profits or profits in the future that are discounted to today's so-called net present values obviously go down. I would say it has become a bit more tricky, I said, for the smaller mid-cap companies that require still money to actually invest into their pipelines to find the so-called risk capital, and that has obviously pressured share prices on top. And then I said we have seen one or the other, I would say, certain structural considerations, that M&A was shut down for quite some time, which was always an important feeder as well for biotech success and investments. I said we had the Federal Trade Commission that suddenly was much more stringent and cracked down on a lot of the deals. We have seen the Inflation Reduction Act that got launched in terms of said what will happen to the US price policies on pharmaceuticals and obviously medications or drugs. I think that has to be digested by market, understood better. There is certain responses, certain overreaction, certain risks as well, to be fair. And ultimately, I said, we need the success, the fundamental success of the industry. So I think it has been an accumulation of all of this. And the pendulum is now very negative, and I think over negative. And in that, we see the chance. Because I said, a lot of the fundamentals have continued to go on very well for us, and progress continues.
Well, let's talk about some of the fundamentals then, or some of the company specifics. I mean, what, you know, your portfolio is divided up into sort of four broad themes around gene therapies, neurological diseases, artificial intelligence, and RNA therapies. I don't know if we've got time to unpick all of those, but I suppose my main question is, you know, what do you think the market is missing? You know, this top-down derating of the market you're investing in. What is being missed? What are the opportunities? What are the valuable things being created by some of the companies you're invested in?
Yeah, so I would actually start on a different topic that you just didn't even mention, because I would say one of the major pain points over the last 2 years plus minus was, for example, oncology. That was as well where, you know, back, I would say, 10 years plus, you know, we saw, I said, the so-called immune oncology, meaning how can we actually trigger the immune system to fight, for example, cancer cells better. That was the big step and big leap back then, in a sense, that I said we saw the first antibodies that actually helped to stimulate so-called immune system to attack the cancer cells better. And since then, that field has, you know, we have seen, I wouldn't say an overcrowding, but quite some competition there. That was obviously one thing that we have to reflect on in terms of how does competition look like? Is there enough room for everybody to move? And I said, some of the trials have failed because said the next step up over, I said, these very good so-called standard of cares of the past has proven to be quite challenging. We see that in target oncology now as well, meaning that you have much better defined patient population that can address. We see there are actually very good clinical results, but the market is obviously waiting to get the proof. Will this be as well an economical success or not? So I think in that there's the risk, but as well, we think the big chance that some of these, as I said, pipeline projects will actually surprise to the upside, both in terms of clinical result, meaning what do they bring to the individual patient, and then in the mid and longer term as well on the commercial side. We think in certain other disease areas, for example, you mentioned RNA. I said the mRNA was obviously one that made major headlines throughout the pandemic. That's another area I can tell you that said back then the market got, you know, ahead of itself in terms of expectation. And when the pandemic got called off or got called to an end, now we see still some vaccination, but now it's all back to the doubt. Will actually next iteration of products, being it, for example, a flu shot, an RSV vaccine, and other products that are based on mRNA technology, we're almost back to the same critical point of view in a sense. Well, can they compete? Will they be successful? Yes or no? And that's why we saw some of these, for example, mRNAs, like in our portfolio in Moderna, obviously divide by five almost, or soon sixfold from the peak to where it is now, because that market wants to see is actually the next big chance for a sustainable and solid mid long term business there. And then said RNA.
Moderna, much of an overreaction is that? Because, you know, their platform presumably proved its worth in developing the vaccine. And other companies did it pretty quickly. It was a success. Why is the market so skeptical that it can't be done again?
Yeah, that's still a bit of a conundrum even for ourselves. I can tell you, it's still, I think, part of that the skepticism towards this new technology, because the pandemic was obviously in a very exceptional situation in terms of the timelines were extremely fast. But on the other hand, we have seen, I said, that if you think of it, all the other, let's just stay on vaccines, for example, all the other vaccine technologies have actually failed or have not been competitive versus mRNA. So we had virus vector based, that's a bit of technical details. We had recombinant subunits. So you can say the classical vaccine technologies we deploy for now decades have proven not competitive against mRNA. And as of today, you pretty much, if you want to get a vaccine or a shot against COVID, you have two options. One is Moderna BioNTech, Moderna, and the other one is Pfizer and BioNTech. So we have actually these two options that are versatile, quick enough, the capacity is there. We know about efficacy and safety. So I think that doubt is still out there. I said, is that then translatable into, I said, will flu and RSV and other approaches work as successfully and as competitive towards the existing technologies? And I think there the market takes now the view, okay, you know, enough time to wait for that. That will take some time. The market obviously doesn't like that you have now a revenue model that comes from, for example, from Moderna, 20 plus billion in revenues and huge profits that are declining now for years and years on the COVID side up until then. I would say the sustainable recurring businesses, the so-called seasonal vaccines, being it said the flu or RSV, or I said if COVID becomes seasonal, how we see it already as of today, then we'll overgrow this. So I think it's a bit of both in terms of the growth skepticism, in a sense, that the growth investors have all left. The value investors are not sure yet, you know, about the mid and long term. So I think that's right now, obviously, where the company is at. But we believe absolutely in the technology, that it's proven itself, it's safe, capacity is there, versatility is there. So we think actually Moderna is on a comeback road. When exactly the stock market will reflect that, we don't know. But I said, from a fundamental stance, we are there much, much more optimistic than, I said, what currently the market price is in. Same for many approaches we have out there.
Well, I was wondering, I mean, a lot of people have heard of Moderna, obviously, and that's a top 10 holding in BB Biotech. But are there any other companies in that top 10 that you'd be worth highlighting, you know, quickly in terms of upcoming trials or
absolutely
developments in the pipeline?
Sorry, might be my voice just... just went away. So we think, for example, if you scale it a bit in terms of large cap, for example, we have a Vertex. I mean, why do I mention that? Vertex is, you can say, in its core business or core franchise, actually maturing. Vertex has revolutionized how you treat, for example, cystic fibrosis patients. So they take a tablet a day nowadays that actually let them live kind of like a normal life, respiratory function close to normal. Hospitalization gone, lung infection gone, etc. So a huge success that has propelled the company to become a large cap with 10 billion in revenues and very substantial profitability. And I would say, why do we stick to Vertex at these days? Is, although I said it's a maturing case in terms of its CF business, we think actually they invest and have a very transformative pipeline. They will launch by year end the first gene editing product. That's said a couple of years ago, if people recall, the gene editing technology received the Nobel Laureate or the Nobel Prize in terms of innovation, how it has transformed not just academia and basic science, but nowadays, as I said, it starts to translate actually in real products for patients. And interesting topic about this, this is a real once in a lifetime, so a curative intent or approach. It's still an invasive procedure, but as I said, for people with very severe bone marrow, let's say blood system disorders, like for example sickle cell or beta thalassemia, for many of them this could mean as I said, once in a lifetime treatment, and then you know you're kind of cured of the disease. And that's a typical example. We'll see further late stage data points in pain. Think of, as I said, pain medication that people, as I said, shall not get addicted to. We have, for example, a huge crisis in terms of opioids and fentanyl addicts, for example, in the US, that starts now to translate as well more and more globally. Things like that are, we are convinced, as I said, are transformative there. For example, wait for late stage clinical data points. As I said, the gene editing is much further than that. There we expect actually a regulatory, for example, approval by year end. So you see there is a substantial sequence of events just in that. I said we had an Argenics. That's now one of the largest, top one and top two. That's our only European name. I would mention that one, and then we probably have to stop for time reason because I could talk on and on.
Oh, there's not. A European company.
There's
in
a
the
European
portfolio.
One European company right now.
Because the whole business
actually,
is so US dominated, isn't it?
Yes, but, it's very US dominated. But a huge success case out of, I said, the Benelux. I said Argenics has or is now on the way to transform, I said, many of the severe autoimmune disorders. Myasthenia gravis is the first one where, I said, these antibodies actually attack tissue from these folks and actually turn them, I said, into a chronic and severe disorders. Very elegant mechanism. That said, the company is now launching, just reported, for example, third quarter results this morning. That said, are outstanding in terms of growth. We think this is going to be a multi-billion opportunity because, said, there are many, many more disorders than not just myasthenia gravis, for example, where, I said, these autoantibodies actually trigger or are the base and the driver of disease. And that's, I think, what now Argenics is on the midst. And as you just point out, our portfolio is highly geared towards the US. That comes out of the concentration approach. And that I said, we build certain areas, or you can say like a matrix function in terms of where do we see gene editing, where do we see gene therapy, where do we see RNA spets in which disease areas, is it autoimmune, is it cancer, etc. And then you have one or two spots that you can fit. And if you invest in, I would say, the leading companies, you very often will end up in a US-centric portfolio around biotech. So Europe has some selective attractive ideas and the rest of the world as well. So we don't have a myopic view on the US, but from a bottom-up approach, I would still say for the time being, you end up very often with a highly geared exposure towards the US if you invest in biotech.
It can't be avoided, really. Which brings us to so the regulatory situation. I mean, in the past, mergers and acquisitions and bids have been a big sort of driver of returns [S2] Yep. [S1] in the sector. But they've in the bear market, they've gone away. Though, of course, low valuations do attract bids. So we have seen big bids coming through in the past year or so. You've not seemed to benefit from them quite so much. So you know, Pfizer, Biohaven.
Well, we've seen, for example, as I said, Pfizer with Seagen, etc. Sure. No, or I said Merck with Prometheus. So we have seen some. So I said, they're still select. I think there are 10 or 11, I would say, deals in the public market, for example, only in brackets in 2023 that would fit our scope. where I invested in. So you have hundreds of companies that are listed. So I would say it's 1 to 1.5% of these companies were taken out. If you run a concentrated portfolio or book, you will have less often a takeover candidate. But if you have one, then obviously the implications are much more severe in a sense, and obviously that drives much more performance and relative performance in the short term. I would say 2 years ago, we saw quite a big break when the FTC blocked certain or wanted to block certain transactions. Amgen Horizon was one that I said got very loud, and where FTC got loud and quite aggressive. They've retracted recently and the deal got consumed. Illumina Grail in the life science tools was another important example in terms of, you know, the FTC, I said, as a Federal Trade Commission, often looks at the monopolistic situation, tries to avoid that, I said, the buyer gains unfair competitive advantages and price advantages and control, so to speak. I said there was a political push for that as well, I think. And I said recently we saw a retraction of that, and I think that shall be a positive. Currently, we face a bit of another conundrum in a sense that, I said, some of these smaller cap companies that have lost a lot of value are actually not willing to sell themselves at a small premium because, I said, that means they are way, way below where they have been. I think that's still a reset that takes place. But we think M&A activity will actually continue because all the large caps, and you can listen to every pharma manager out there, if they call it bolt-on acquisition or licensing and BD, they know exactly that without external innovation, they can't sustain their growth profiles and their growth trajectory. So we think that will remain, if you want to say so, an industry evolution over time. It's a bit cyclical, I agree, but definitely something we expect to continue. And also said the last deal we had was Myovant, announced in 2022 and consummated this spring. So it didn't help us on the performance side, but on a cash level. But I said, we think a lot of attractive assets and technology in the portfolio represented. I said, rather concentrated. If one or the other will make it, you will see that. I said, Propel, obviously, our performance quite a bit. It's not our strategy to invest in takeover candidates per se, but we think, I said, ultimately, if you have strong assets and strong technology, one or the other will eventually be will be picked. And we had huge successes in the past, an Actelion in Switzerland that got taken over for 30 billion. We have large deals like Celgene that got taken out by Bristol. We have obviously seen in the ecology space, you know, the first generation CAR T companies like Juno or Kite or Pharmacyclic. So we have had one over the other. Hep C was a perfect example of the past, where we had then substantial performance contribution. And I said, I'm not hesitant, or actually not, I have no doubt that as well in the future, BB Biotech will have substantial participation as well. I cannot tell you when and which company it is, but I'm convinced from the quality and content we have that this will be part of our future as well.
Yeah, it's slightly random, isn't it? Or which ones get bid for, I suppose, but and which ones you hold. But in terms of the kind of these, you know, the bad conditions in the capital markets, 80% of your portfolio is either profitable or financed to reach profitability. So how long is the runway for those that are still loss making?
Yes, so I said if you think of a classical biotech evolution, you know, it takes 6 to 8 years for a product to start clinical trial, to get to regulatory authorities, get launched, and then another 2-3 years to reach actually profitability. So you take a substantial amount of capital to get from starting to finish line, meaning, you know, from start of a project all the way to profitability, and timelines as well. So we have in our portfolio right now, I said 80%+ that is financed through. I would say, you know, plus minus, what is it, around, I think, 30%+ that's already now sustainable, profitable. Said plus minus half of the portfolio that's on the go to get profitable. I said that obviously depends a bit on the speed and velocity of that, but they're financed through, so we feel quite safe around that. And then I said around 15% to 20% that require capital, and that goes all the way. Some companies that we call out there, for example, an interesting case is Revolution Medicine, that will just merge now with actually a cash box and will soon have a balance sheet of almost 2 billion of cash, but we qualified as not yet clear if that's sufficient to actually reach profitability. It could be the last financing, we don't know. all the way to some, I would call almost micro cap companies like Molecular Templates or Black Diamond, where we know they have, you know, 1.5, 2 years of cash on hand. So these companies have to do something, either a business development deal, meaning they get some non-dilutive capital from a pharma partner that licenses an asset or something out of the company. Shareholders give the company more capital in the near term. That can be quite dilutive because said valuation are substantially under pressure. Or last but not least, one or the other company could be sold because, as I said, the valuation discrepancy is there. And I said, for some of these, there is even the risk that they go under, meaning as of today's situation, we have in this microcap world as well companies that will ultimately have the risk to disappear.
Yeah. I mean,
so this extreme situation means very large upside potential, but I said higher or much higher risk than, for example, where they have been 3 or 4 years ago. But I said that's for us, luckily, I said a very small percentage currently of the portfolio. I said the large degree is very stable and I think very well set.
Yeah, that's the classic sort of biotech proposition. I mean, clearly there are high risks there and potentially high rewards. And investors have been risk averse. Do you think with the signs that interest rates may be peaking in the US, that this top-down macroeconomic pressure will abate and investor confidence might improve and sentiment towards your sector might improve as well?
Yes, I think I, on that front, I said we have seen or I have experienced now in my 2 decades multiple very cyclical behaviors from markets. Sometimes said it was capital market driven, sometimes said it was fundamental driven or at least perceived fundamental, like I said, the Obamacare that I mentioned. I think IRA is right now such a situation. But I think it's we don't obviously have a crystal ball regarding the macroeconomic environment, and we have gotten proven all wrong over the last 1.5 years as well, how steep certain, at least the US situation, has evolved. I think it's a certain visibility would be already good that, you know, high is high enough. I know as well there's some expectation for a certain break in 2024, meaning interest rates could slightly lower again. I think visibility that it doesn't go much higher than where we are today would be already of help. Ultimately, it will be the fundamental side that has to win, meaning
do you think
has to succeed and that has to be the overperformer over the capital market. And I think then you will see as well capital flows back. So I think it's a bit of a cyclicality or self-fulfilling prophecy there. Capital markets shall not get worse. That would be my wish list in terms of that. And then the success case of the industry will prove itself. I think from then on, we'll see more and more capital flow back because that capital flows over the last 2 years have been very negative, meaning a lot of capital has been withdrawn. It's not just has gone lower, as for example, due to performance, but withdrawn actually actively. And I said M&A and BD has become the dominant player in actually financing the industry. That continues, as said. So if the broader capital markets, you know, rediscover, so to speak, this as a growth area of attractive returns and opportunity, then we think as well there is an opportunity for substantial performance upside from where we are as of today.
And do you think in 30 years' time, looking back at now, do you think the current difficulties will look like a blip, like some of the downturns look like a bit of a blip on your existing performance chart?
I am actually convinced about this because I said that sound a bit brave. Obviously, nobody knows what's going to happen in the next 3 decades. But if you think of, you know, the 12% return compounded over 30 years, you know, you just mentioned numbers, you go 15 to 20 times in value. And we have seen, for example, I said back in the 99-2000 or then the correction in 2002-03, people thought we will never reach these highs. Look at our long-term chart. I mean, this upcycle and then substantial correction of back then, as I said today, looks like a blip. That's because I said the long-term compounding effect of this industry, we are convinced will drive the performance and will reach obviously new highs in the future.
Okay, well, on that slightly positive note, we'll perhaps leave it there. But just one more thing. I mean, the company celebrating 30 years. What are you up to this month to mark the occasion?
Yeah, I said we'll have, I think, an event that I said highlights, some of the transformative potential. One topic we touched on, that was said the mRNA technology. So we're looking forward to obviously have Moderna present at this event and explain, I said, how the future looks like, not just how the last couple of years looked like. We will have one of the board members, luckily I said, Mats Thompson, that's in our board, who comes from the Novo Nordisk side, talk about obesity. That's currently, you know, the therapeutic area that's obviously in the hot seat, so to speak, in terms of performance, meaning, you know, very steep adoption of products, very positive share price performance for the Eli Lillys and Novo Nordisk of the world. And then our chairman will, as I said, not just look back the three decades, but will, as I said, there, you know, to give a certain outlook and what we expect for the future. So looking forward to such an event. And as I said, then obviously that we can use those messages and lines as well to transport them and convey the message that, as I said, biotech and BB Biotech is a very attractive investment opportunity.
Great. Okay, Daniel, well, that's all the time we got time for, I'm afraid. But yeah, many happy returns to BB Biotech, and let's hope returns start to improve and return back to their former higher level. In the meantime, Daniel, very good to talk to you. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.